You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Andrew Hammond, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you conversations with practitioners, authors, and scholars who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please reach out to us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. If you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you listen on. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
Our guest today is Nigel West. His true name is Rupert Allison, one of the best-known British historians and authors on intelligence books. He has written some 25 books. He's a former Conservative Member of Parliament, some 10 years, and he still regularly teaches both here and in Europe, and even on cruises from time to time. He's the European editor of the World Intelligence Review, based here in Washington, and European editor of the International Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence. He has been called the experts by some in terms of intelligence, and many believe that his revelations are so precise, it is almost as if he worked for intelligence, but he doesn't. So, Nigel, welcome.
Thank you.
And I think what might be fascinating to our readers is the frequent references in spy literature, certainly here at the museum, to the Cambridge Five. You probably have know that case as well and have written as much as anyone. Could you, for us, give us an overview, a summary, an insight into the Cambridge Five?
These were five young men who at university at the height of the Depression in the early 1930s made an ideological commitment to the Soviet Union. Their motivation is hard to understand now, but it is very clear that this was a deep, long-term political commitment to the Soviet cause. And what's fascinating is that they were all recruited before they ever really had access to classified information. And having volunteered to the Soviets, the NKVD, at that time the principal Soviet intelligence service, directed their careers. And of the five, four of them became pretty significant members of what I guess you might call the secret establishment or the corridors of power in Whitehall. Not enough to influence policy, but sufficient to betray political trends, policy decisions, intelligence operations, personalities, methodologies. Altogether, these five individuals, from a period really from stretching from 1936 to 1951, and you could argue in the case of Kim Philby up until January 1963, that these people represented the greatest hemorrhage of classified history, perhaps in anybody's memory. So they consisted of Kim Philby, who was self-recruited after he left Cambridge. He subsequently recruited a friend of his who was still at university, Guy Burgess. He recruited one of his tutors, a man called Anthony Blunt, and he then talent-spotted John Cairncross, and a fifth individual who subsequently went into the Foreign Office was Donald MacLean. And all five of these spies were directed into particular departments of state. So Kim Philby eventually joined in September 1941 the Secret Intelligence Service, an organization that he remained a member of until he was fired in November 1951. So he was responsible for providing thousands of documents, and I know they're thousands because I've seen them in the KGB archives, thousands of documents from the British Secret Intelligence Service, the holy of holies, if you like, within the British establishment. His close friend, Guy Burgess, also joined briefly the Secret Intelligence Service, worked for a branch called Section D, and then he pursued a Foreign Office career. He'd also worked for the BBC, and he was immensely well connected. One of his friends, Anthony Blunt, a fellow predatory homosexual, joined the Territorial Army in 1938 through the intervention of his brother, and then in June 1940 joined the Security Service, MI5. And he remained in MI5 until May 1945. He did one further job for MI5 in Rome in September 1945, and then he left the Security Service. And he ultimately would not be positively identified as a spy, although he came under suspicion in 1951, until April 1964. And he remained in the UK, and ultimately in November 1979 he was exposed as a traitor by the Prime Minister. And by that time he'd been appointed Keeper of the King's Pictures, then Keeper of the Queen's Pictures, and in 1954 had received a knighthood. So again, another example of somebody directed into a secret part of government. John Cairncross, one of the most brilliant men of his generation, often called the fifth man. He was the last to be recruited, the only person in history to have become the top graduate in both the Home and Foreign Office civil service examination, joined the Foreign Office, then switched to the Cabinet Office, then worked at Bletchley Park as a codebreaker, as a cryptanalyst. Then he went to the Secret Intelligence Service and ultimately ended up in the Ministry of Supply. But throughout his period in the secret corridors, he tipped off the Soviets to the development of an atomic weapon, supplied information about Enigma code-breaking at Bletchley Park, and then towards the end of his civil service career, compromised information relating to Britain's civil nuclear power program. He resigned from the civil service in 1951 when Burgess and MacLean defected. And ultimately he lived abroad, and in 1963 he made a confession while he was working at Northwestern University. And he was interviewed by MI5 and the Secret the Security Service, the FBI. And then finally we have Donald MacLean, who joined the Foreign Office, worked in Paris in 1940, came back to England, was then posted to the United States, and he was less involved in secret intelligence matters, but more involved in policy, certainly relating to nuclear policy and cooperation between the United Kingdom and the United States. He defected with Guy Burgess in 1951, and ultimately was placed in, or had been placed in charge of the American Department of the Foreign Office. So these five spies provided a window into Britain's policy-making establishment for Moscow.
Were any of them ever tried, brought to trial for espionage, for treason?
None of the five were ever prosecuted, and there were good reasons for this. Burgess and Maclean defected in May 1951, just when Maclean had been identified as a Soviet spy suspect and was going to be brought in for interrogation. He skipped the country 2 days before that interrogation was scheduled to begin. Their departure compromised Kim Philby. He was interrogated. He denied all involvement in either espionage or tipping off Burgess and Maclean, but he was nevertheless fired from the Secret Intelligence Service in November 1951, and he was never prosecuted because when eventually he was offered an immunity from prosecution in January 1963, he fled Beirut, where he was then working as a journalist, and ended up in Moscow, where he eventually died. So that leaves just two of the five left. John Cancross was fired, or was allowed to resign from the civil service when he came under suspicion in 1951 as a consequence of the Burgess and Maclean defections, but there was never any evidence against him. He went overseas, worked for the United Nations, and then was professor of Romance languages at Northwestern University. And then the last of the five was Anthony Blunt. He remained in the United Kingdom, and it wasn't until, although he was interrogated 13 times between May 1951 and April 1964, he was offered and he accepted an immunity from prosecution. And he was the principal source of the information that we have up until now relating to the damage that the five did, how they operated, who their contacts were, the kind of information that they passed to Moscow. Now, of course, in Moscow, many of the archives have been opened up, and we can see for ourselves the scale of their treachery.
Will, do you think those files, those records which you have seen, is there any chance any of those would be made available to the public?
Oh, yes. The documents that have been made available to individual historians, the Russians are pretty commercially orientated, and they are perfectly happy to enter into agreements whereby documents will be declassified at the moment of publication where individual historians have made that agreement with them. That, of course, is an anathema in the United Kingdom or the United States, where the governments declassify documents, and then historians are on their own to make what best they can in the scramble to look at these documents and to interpret them and to represent them. The Russians take a rather more commercial view of these things. They are, after all, a capitalist country.
Yes. Nigel, did you ever have an opportunity to meet any of the Cambridge Five?
Yes, I spent a long time with Anthony Blunt. I'd been commissioned to write a wartime history of the Security Service, and he agreed to see me in 1981, and specifically to discuss his wartime Security Service work. And of course, on the basis that he was the only person, practically the only person in MI5, who was deliberately breaking the need-to-know rule, the compartmentalization rules, where he was looking at information and then meeting his Soviet contact on a weekly basis and passing over hundreds of documents. He had a particular insight into the workings of the Security Service during the Second World War. So he was of enormous help to me. And he appeared to cooperate candidly and indeed revealed to me the identity of a spy that he had personally recruited and run himself, a man who was in MI14 called Leo Long, and who I wrote about in 1981. And we also discussed John Cancross, whose name was relatively unknown at that time. And subsequently I went to interview John Cancross, and he was a little less forthcoming, but I got to know him much better in later years. And in 1996, just before his death, I helped ghost his autobiography.
We'll be right back after this.
Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
You mentioned that you talked to Anthony Blunt in 1981. Now, this was some 2 years after he'd been exposed.
Yes, he was exposed in November 1979 by the Prime Minister, stripped of his knighthood, publicly humiliated. He was angered because he believed that the offer of immunity that he had been granted in April 1964 implied an element of confidentiality. Actually, there was nothing ever put in writing. He was offered an immunity from prosecution by the Attorney General, Sir John Hobson. But nobody said anything. Of course, it was implied. It was in everybody's interests that this should be confidential. But in November 1979, the Prime Minister, who was, after all, a barrister, qualified lawyer, was advised by her then Attorney General, Sir Michael Havers, that it would be impossible for her to stand by, given the oath that she had given to the court, and allow Anthony Blunt, who was then contemplating a legal action to protect his reputation, to stand by and watch him perjure himself in court. And on that basis, Mrs. Thatcher, horrified that Anthony Blunt had, in effect, got away with treachery and had not been publicly exposed, made a statement to the House of Commons which wrecked his career, and Anthony Blunt didn't exactly go into hiding, but he kept his head down and gave only one interview to the Times newspaper, and thereafter refused to discuss his involvement with espionage with anybody except for me.
And that resulted in a book, did it?
That was a book called MI5, British Security Service Operations 1909 to 1945. And as an addendum, because Soviet penetration of the security service was obviously an important aspect to MI5's wartime work, there is an account of the espionage of Anthony Blunt, of John Cairncross, and of Leo Long.
Now, early on, Philby was regarded as a rising young man with the potential to perhaps end up as head of the service, even. That certainly is the aura that seems to surround him. Was that, in fact, true?
I think that this is part of the mythology. I mean, there is no doubt that he was a very personable, remarkable man. There were very few people in the Secret Intelligence Service at the beginning of the war, even with a university degree. Most of the people employed were retired army or naval officers who had not taken the academic path. Philby was charismatic. He was the longest-serving foreign correspondent in Spain during the Spanish Civil War. He spoke French, German, and Spanish fluently. And because of his work as a journalist, he could write sentences with a beginning, a middle, and an end, which retired army officers tend not to be able to do. So he was a rising star within the Secret Intelligence Service, but he was handicapped, first of all, by a terrible speech impediment. He had a very bad stutter. Secondly, he came of mixed race. within the British establishment at that time, the fact that his grandmother had been an Indian would have excluded him from high office. He was known as Shishi, which means in Hindi half and half. And that made life very difficult. Quite apart from that, he was an alcoholic, drinking a bottle of whiskey a day. And on top of that, he had four children born out of wedlock. And on top of that, his first wife, of course, had been a communist, and he was suspected of having murdered his second wife. So, given those factors, I think it is reasonable to presume that the British establishment, whilst being willing to exploit his very considerable talents and charm, would not have been willing ever to have contemplated him as chief of the Secret Intelligence Service.
I think those who take an interest in intelligence history look back on the Cambridge Five and all associated with it, and one wonders what was the effect of the exposure of the Cambridge Five both on the British service itself and on its relations with its primary allies, the American services.
I think, first of all, it's hard to judge the impact, but I do not believe that any of the five betrayed information that resulted in the deaths of many individuals. We have proof that Anthony Blunt, and he readily accepted, that he was responsible for identifying a Secret Intelligence Service source in Moscow who was executed, and I have a very long confession from this spy before he was executed, which will appear in Triple X, which is the next book from the KGB archives. Kim Philby has been credited with being responsible for the deaths of many of the partisans, saboteurs, people who were infiltrated into Albania after the Second World War. But whilst it is certainly true that he betrayed the policy decision that had been made to run those operations, there is no evidence that he had access to the kind of tactical information that these particular spies will be landing on this beach on this particular night, the kind of information that would be of direct use to a security apparatus in Albania. So I do not believe that the five, although they hugely compromised the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park, the Secret Intelligence Service, MI5, I do not believe that their actions resulted in the deaths apart from this one man known as Gibby's spy, because his handler had been Harold Gibson. That is not a particularly popular view, but I've never seen any evidence to the contrary. It is certainly the case that Anthony Blunt neutralized any anti-Soviet long-term impact that the security service had on Soviet intelligence investigations in the United Kingdom, and it is certainly the case that Kim Philby identified the personalities and the operations, and where he could, the names of sources for the Secret Intelligence Service. But again, I've yet to see a name that can be directly attributed to Kim Philby.
You know, as you and I speak, they have just released in Great Britain secret memoir, confession, if you will, of Anthony Blunt. And obviously you worked closely with him, you knew a lot about the man. Were there any surprises in that for you?
Not really. And the reason was that we discussed this, and he said that he was going to write a short memoir. It was 30,000 words, which is sort of less than half, really, or probably a quarter of the kind of book that you would be looking at. And he told me that the reason why he didn't wish it to be published in his lifetime or even soon after his death was because he had particularly betrayed the trust and confidence of his brother Christopher, whom he had manipulated in order to obtain a commission in the Territorial Army in 1938, which had set him on his path to joining the Intelligence Corps and then the intelligence corps had led to an offer of work for the security service. And he felt, he certainly expressed no remorse to me ever about having betrayed anybody except the trust of his brother, and that was the reason why he kept it quiet. He didn't disclose in his memoirs anything that surprised any of the people who were specialists. He didn't identify other people that he had recruited, like Leo Long, whose name doesn't appear anywhere in the manuscript. He doesn't mention Kim Philby, whom he knew quite well, Donald McLean, whom he hardly knew, and he mentions the fact that he had been pitched or recruited by Guy Burgess, and he described that very simply as the biggest mistake of his life, which I think you might consider to be something of an understatement.
Mm. Nigel, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you this afternoon, and I should comment for the readers that this extraordinary overview, if you will, of the Cambridge Five with insights into some of their motives and behavior has been delivered without a single note or reference to any other reference or book or anything else. And so I sort of get that. I get a very a good idea of why they call you the experts' experts. We look forward to your next book, which I think you said will be called Triple X, and which will include material that you described in this afternoon, specifically some of these documents that were delivered by Kim Philby into the hands of Soviet intelligence. So, Nigel, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to doing another one with you.
Thank you.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 non-profit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and would like to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.